This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Thank you, Kathleen and Connie and Ron and everybody who's been responsible for a really exciting and interesting day full of original and creative thinking about the news media in the Middle East and around the world, and so much of it gratifyingly about us. What's more pleasant than that? One of the last stories that I did for Nightline before leaving was actually part of a sort of follow-up tour 60 days after the tsunami. And because we were going to exit Indonesia through Jakarta, I arranged a side trip that had nothing to do with the tsunami. But there is a boarding school outside the city of Solo, Pesantren Angruki, which is sort of the Harvard and West Point of Jamaah Islamiyah, which is al-Qaeda in Indonesia, and an especially vicious and virulent terrorist group. And before I had my interview with the assistant headmaster, the headmaster himself was imprisoned for his role in inspiring the terrorist attack on the tourist facilities in Bali, I took a little tour of the campus. And it was about two or three blocks of two-story buildings, classroom buildings. And typically, in front of each of the classroom buildings, there was a little bulletin board that had the classes that were taught in that classroom. And so by making the grand tour, I was able to figure out what the curriculum was at this prep school for terrorists. And basically, it was a very conventional synthesis of what might be expected from a top-rank public or private secular school in Indonesia and a top-rank religious-oriented school, a super high-class madrasa, plus two. And the plus two courses were computer science, which students were required to take in all of their years, and English. And when I finally got to the assistant headmaster, I confessed to him that computer science made perfect sense to me, but that I was a little surprised that given the ideological inclination of the school, and he had regaled me with his admiration for Osama bin Laden and had let me know that all of the good works that the U.S., particularly the U.S. Navy, but the U.S. government had done, and all of the fundraising that ex-presidents Bush and Clinton had done in the wake of the tsunami stood for nothing as far as he was concerned. America was still the national Satan and was to be resisted in every detail. And so I said, given all of that, why is it that you require all your students to study English? And he said, Mr. Marish, whether we like it or not, this is the 21st century, and we know that when it comes to politics and science and philosophy, and in fact any intellectual pursuit, English is the global language. And we want our students to take part in those conversations. Little did I know that, you know, in 2 years he was talking about my audience. And if you're immediately saying, does that mean that he's saying he wants to talk to terrorists? The answer is yes, absolutely. Because I'm convinced that me and my ideas are far more dangerous to them than they and their ideas are to me. And that, in fact, the best way to wean them of their extremely vicious and narrow ideas is by engaging in free discussion with them about those ideas. Because the only way to defeat a bad argument is with better arguments. And this is not only a very American concept, it's in fact a Jeffersonian concept. Thomas Jefferson preached democracy through information and believed that a radically well-educated populace was the cure to all of the problems of malgovernance. And this is the principle that Al Jazeera Arabic and now Al Jazeera English is based on. Freewheeling discussions based on very careful and fact-based reporting. Al Jazeera is an American-style news organization. And by that, I mean, unlike European journalism, which almost always proceeds from some kind of ideological, philosophical, or party base, American journalism proceeds strictly from the facts. And so does Al Jazeera's. And all of the discussions and analysis that follow on both the Arabic and the English language channels are deeply rooted in the facts of our reporting, which is, I think, what makes us an excellent and worthy news channel. What distinguishes Al Jazeera from the competition? Three things. First off, unlike all of our English language news channel competitors, who invest about 80% of their news gathering resources, their reporters, their camera crews, their producers, their bureaus, and their intellectual attention on North America, Western Europe, Japan, and Israel, Al Jazeera focuses about 80% of our resources everywhere else. And unlike BBC World and CNN International, both of which do have a global network of bureaus, wherever CNN is, almost all of their news resources are Americans. Wherever the BBC is, almost all of their news resources are British. But wherever Al Jazeera's bureaus are, the people inhabiting them tend to be from the very same region that they are reporting. This has several inherent advantages. First off, of course, the locals know the turf better, or in reporting terms, they are almost always possessors of the better Rolodex. They've got more and more varied sources, even than the most experienced foreign correspondents based overseas, much less the parachute journalists like I was for 16 years with Nightline. But also their role is different. In addition to the professional role of journalist, they are role models within their own society. Since most of their society does not have a thoroughly developed culture of journalism, does not have a large professional cadre of journalists, does not have a well-established rule book and ethics code for journalists, they, in addition to reporting, must enact all of these ethical codes and professional skill books, if you will. This places an additional burden on them, but I think it's a burden that makes them better reporters than the foreign correspondents or parachute journalists with whom they compete in the global news universe. The third distinction between us and all of our competition is we go slower. We do fewer stories per half hour, which allows us to do at least several of those stories every half hour in some depth, shading in the tones of gray, the nuances of ethical or moral issues, and not be stuck with the sort of black and white stereotypical cliches which the 1 minute and 40 second news piece imposes on the people who have to execute it. So those are the three hallmarks of Al Jazeera English, that we go slower and try and bring you more depth, that our reporting teams are, if you will, more authentic and more knowledgeable of the regions that they report, and that our focus is largely from the south looking north rather than the north looking south. And actually, there's a fourth distinction, which is in some ways even more interesting than the first three, and that is that we have four separate news bases. Oh, the home office is in Doha, in Qatar, and it does assume the lion's share of programming. Once we're doing 24 hours a day of original programming, and I think we're up to about 19 hours now, but once we fully occupy the 24-hour clock, the division of labor is going to be 12 hours out of Doha and 4 apiece out of, respectively, London, Washington, and Kuala Lumpur. And if you do the math and sort of add Kuala Lumpur to Doha, that gives you 16 hours from a southern perspective versus 8 hours out of London and Washington from the northern, or if you prefer, western perspective. And the math is probably good information that the overall orientation of the channel is south-looking north rather than north-looking south. Or as I like to put it, up until now, the flow of global information in the English language has all been direct current from the notional north or west to the south, and we're bringing in the principle of alternating current, which is very, very important and should be especially and painfully important to Americans in this year 2007, since it does seem to me that the one indelible message of our terrible misadventure in Iraq is that ignorance kills. That almost all of the terrible miscalculations that the Bush administration made about its incursion into Iraq were based on pure ignorance. They didn't know what they didn't know. And almost all of those vacancies of knowledge have come back to haunt us and to kill Americans and to kill Iraqis in even far greater numbers. So that I believe that we are providing a unique and very important service in that if you tune in, God forbid, for 24 consecutive hours, you should see virtually the same roster of important stories. Everybody in all four of our news centers, being professional journalists, have a very cognate sense of what is significant news, but that as the clock turns and as the responsibility shifts from Doha to London to Washington to Kuala Lumpur, each of those news bases in our system has the autonomy not only to assign its own story coverage out of the bureaus that are subsidiary to it, but also to stack our own shows. So that if, for example, Doha's story priority is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 13, 14, 15, when after Doha's 12 hours the focus shifts to Western Europe, London may stack the stories 3, 4, 7, 11, 1, 2, 8, 9, 10. And when it then shifts to us in the Western Hemisphere, our priorities and our point of view may dictate an entirely different story lineup that may in fact be 15, 14, 13, down to 3, 2, 1. And then we shift to Kuala Lumpur. And so if, God forbid, you watched for 24 hours, what you would see enacted is my favorite invented word, parallaxism. You all know that parallax is the phenomenon that the same point viewed from two different points of an arc will appear different because point of view is defining. And so the Al Jazeera view of the world is actually a view times four. And each of those four views should be slightly distinct, slightly different from the other three, because of the region and the interests of the region and the perspective of the region that we report from. Washington, our region, is the Western Hemisphere. We have, in addition to a very large Washington bureau, bureaus in New York and Los Angeles, Caracas, Buenos Aires, Sao Paulo, Bogota, and Mexico City. And I would say that over our first 5-6 months of programming, the reporting out of the Washington Bureau and its dependencies probably does add up to about 60% Latin America to 40% North America, which is, again, I think, a good indication of the overall view of the channel. This is very important, obviously, to the people who live in the notional South, because it asserts that they are important, that the stories that involve them and their region are as important as the traditional First World stories, and that their own perspective and the perspective of their own credentialed experts are as valid or more so than the conventionally resorted to experts in Washington, New York, London, or Moscow. This is equally important to the United States and our viewers, because it fills a gap of uncoverage, a gap of potential ignorance that is, again, I think Iraq teaches us, will come back to bite you on the ass. Ignorance in today's world is simply a very, very dangerous condition. And we think that the kind of journalism that Al Jazeera English practices is the best antidote to it. Now, the other distinction to us, that we go slower, that we do fewer stories, I think directly relates to the nature of our audience. And our audience is global, and as our Grand Master Wadar Khanfar told Frontline when they asked him who he saw as his audience, his answer was, everyone in the world who speaks English. Which means that about 80% of our audience are people who speak English as a second language. And if you think about the implications of that, I think you'll understand why our audience is the most empowering audience for journalists imaginable. When you see someone who has a second language, you know immediately by definition that they're ambitious people. Because who else will breach the boundaries of language and culture unless they're ambitious, unless they are curious, unless they are imaginative people? It also predicts that they are better educated people. It predicts much less reliably, happily, that they are above middle income people, but you know, there is a whole tradition of working class autodidacts whose range of knowledge and curiosity amazes you. I mean, 30 years ago, you could regularly rely on the story of the shoemaker who made $100 a week but had a box at the Metropolitan Opera because he was a high culture opera buff. Nightline, notwithstanding all of the Lexus ads, had a very strong working class component in the audience. They may not have been wealthy people, but they were people with intellectual ambition who sought out Nightline because it gave them more depth and breadth on the news than any other program in American television. Well, that's our audience. Not to mention these potential terrorists and their prey. Now, it's stupid and futile to deny that Al Jazeera coverage begets terrorists. It is futile and stupid to deny that there are psychologically marginal or extremely zealous personalities who watch Al Jazeera's coverage, let's say, of the war in Iraq and the devastation that's being visited on the Iraqis, essentially by outsiders from the West. And remember, this is a post-colonial territory, and memories of colonialism are very much alive and very important and undeniable within the culture. Where was I going? Right. So a lot of people will see that coverage, will see the American tanks, for example, who spent 2 weeks pursuing terrorists inside the sacred cemetery of the city of Najaf, the place where about 80% of all Iraqi Shia are buried. Yes, we were lured in there by terrorists. We felt an imperative to root them out. They would not go, they would not heed the pleas of Ayatollah Sistani or any of the Shia hierarchy to leave. there are all sorts of reasons why the Battle of Najaf Cemetery took place. Let me tell you that to an Iraqi Shia audience watching that on Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya or even Al Iraqiya, the Iraqi government television, which also gave live coverage to these battles, were profoundly shocked and horrified to see such sacred ground polluted by combat. It would be as if a foreign army fought a pitched battle inside Arlington Cemetery, and maybe even worse than that. So that there's no question that that kind of coverage can beget the worst imaginable response. But you know what? That's the way information is. Information is always a double-edged sword. Information can always be taken the wrong way. And the cure for that is not the suppression of information. And in fact, every poll that has been done in the Middle East over the last 10 years, affectionately known as the Al Jazeera era, shows that the more that Al Jazeera and the other very active satellite news channels in the Middle East show of the press releases of Osama bin Laden or Ayman al-Zawahiri or the late Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And the more that the news channels cover what al-Qaeda and the fellow terrorists do, the more disaffected the overwhelming majority of Arabic-speaking citizens are from the radicals, because Arabic speakers understand sociopathological behavior as well as English speakers or any other language group. And so when they hear the rant of bin Laden, even though they may, in fact, admire the fact that he stands up to the colonialist or neo-colonialist oppressor, the overwhelming majority say, I wouldn't want him on my block. I wouldn't support him. I wouldn't harbor his people. And, in fact, with each succeeding poll, the majority of anti-Al-Qaeda opinion grows. That's the beautiful part of information, is that people can learn from it. And again, this is what Jeffersonian democracy is all about, the patient pursuit of facts, as he called it, acquiring knowledge so that you can apply judgment to it. And Jefferson, perhaps more radically than any other American, believed in the wisdom of popular judgment. Was willing to put up with the occasional mistakes of popular judgment because he believed in the long run popular wisdom would prevail and that there was no alternative and certainly no better alternative on the path to democracy than allowing popular wisdom to prevail. So Al Jazeera is, it seems to me, an exercise in particularly American, even Jeffersonian, democracy. And its impact on the Arabic-speaking world and the Islamic world simply cannot be overestimated. I think you have to go back to the great Arab Renaissance of Averroes and Avicenna in the 11th and 12th centuries to find positive inputs into the culture of a scale and depth of Al Jazeera. What did Al Jazeera do? Well, it brought into a culture where previously all television news had been state-run. And the states of the Middle East are quite justly known for the narrowness of their point of view, and state-run television news reflected that mechanically. The first 5 minutes of every newscast was whatever the head of state happened to do that day. All other information was safely neutered and denatured. It was information that had no credibility and no added information value to it. 10 and a half years ago, enters Al Jazeera with its very fact-based reporting and its absolutely freewheeling debate, all gathered around the motto of the opinion, and its opposite. And these were not just McLaughlin Group slugfests. These were discussions often of very high intellectual content and very deep conviction and heavy passion. And they carried with them something that was absolutely new to the language group and the culture, which was an existential imperative. This was a culture in which authority was all trickled down, in which if you wanted to know about right conduct, you effectively consulted literally the scriptures, the Quran and the Haditha, the holy book and the sort of chapter book of the lives of Muhammad and his faithful followers. If you wanted more contemporary advice, you either went to your local religious or political leader, or you listened to what state-owned television and radio told you. There was little inquiry, no dissent, and an absolute absence of that existential imperative, which is not just watch this opinion and its opposite, but choose one. And over the 10 years, as the programming became more influential and more sophisticated and more developed, a secondary level of existential imperative appeared, which was, don't just choose an opinion, but act on it. There are social, civic, political consequences of your choice. Follow through on them, whether it be within your family or clan or tribe or city or state or mosque, but use your mind. Come to your own conclusions and start acting on those conclusions. The changes in the daily politics of the region have been immense. And now the Middle East is, in spite of a heavy majority of very repressive governments, has become a real blooming garden of blogs, of websites, of informational exchanges, in addition to the home now to several hundred television channels, of which I think close to a dozen are all news channels, each of them having their own perspective, its own perspective, on the world. Happily, Al Jazeera maintains its market dominance. Al Arabiya, which is financed by the Saudi government, has become a formidable competitor. But, you know, we were watching the Frontline film on global news wars, as they call them. And as their reporter enters the building that houses Al Arabiya, Al Arabiya's motto floats into view. And their motto is, "We see hope everywhere." To which I would respond, "Well, that's great, because Al Jazeera's motto is, 'We see news everywhere.'" And as Al Arabiya became more and more formidable a competitor and gained more and more market share at the expense of Al Jazeera, the momentum of all of that was broken during the war in Lebanon last summer, because the Saudi government literally didn't know what to hope for. They knew they hated Hezbollah and Saeed Nasrallah. They knew they didn't dare express open sympathy for Israel. And it took them a week, probably a week of watching Al Jazeera, to figure out that the story of the war, which is always Al Jazeera's primary theme in its war coverage, is, hey, innocent civilians are being murdered here. For what? How can you justify this level of destruction and slaughter? And during the week that the Saudi government couldn't figure out that that was the message of the war, Al Arabiya essentially went to sleep on the war. They couldn't figure out a take on it, and so they didn't take it at all. And so the whole Arab public knew where to go for war coverage, and they tuned in Al Jazeera, and by the end of the 33-day conflict, Al Jazeera's market share was back in the 60 and 70 percentiles, and Al Arabiya was back in the 20 percentiles. That's because we do see news everywhere, and we try and cover it as news. I'm sure you've heard Don Rumsfeld say that we are the mouthpiece of Osama bin Laden. Well, it's true that Al Jazeera Arabic became the first place that Osama bin Laden would send his video news releases. That's really hard to figure out, isn't it? Why do you think the Unabomber sent a letter to the New York Times? Because in our culture, the best disseminated, most credible news outlet is the New York Times, and he wanted to reach the widest possible audience with his rant. Well, Osama feels exactly the same way. He knows the market share percentages, and he knows who has credibility, and it's Al Jazeera. But when he sends a video news release to Al Jazeera, what happens to it? And the answer is, it's treated as news. It's never broadcast live or quasi-live. It's never broadcast in its entirety. The newsworthy aspects of it are selected into sound bites and are then surrounded by commentary and analysis, exactly what journalists are supposed to do with breaking news. Two things ought to be noted about Al Jazeera and Osama. Number one, every bit of news that Osama has committed on Al Jazeera has been picked up by virtually every other television news organization in the world within 20 minutes of Al Jazeera putting it on. Why? Because it's news. So, yes, we do broadcast that material, but what's the alternative? What if we, like Al Arabiya, focused on hope and decided that Osama bin Laden is a hopeless enterprise and therefore should be suppressed? Who would be damaged by this? Al Jazeera. Because the Arab world knows Osama bin Laden exists. It knows more or less what he stands for. And if Al Jazeera pretended to present world news absent the jihadist point of view, most of their viewers would recognize it as a bowdlerized, censored, and therefore incredible world being presented to them. Trust Jefferson. Give it all to them. They're human beings. They have intelligence. They have sensibility. They can sort out the bad arguments from the good arguments. And seeing the bad arguments is the only way to defeat them. You cannot defeat a bad argument in absentia. And in fact, you know, one of the wonderful things about the lockout of Al Jazeera English from the United States is through sympathetic reviewers like everybody from John Stewart to the New York Times, our sort of marketing niche is the brave little channel they won't let you see. There are worse ways to be marketed in this wicked world. It is, though, kind of, you know, it's laughable in some ways, but it's tragic. As an American journalist, I've always been both proud and supremely comforted to know that because I am an American journalist, I have more professional freedom than journalists anywhere else in the world. You say, well, what about the United Kingdom, Great Britain? That's a pretty free state. In 1978, for 2020, at the time, the leader of the Liberal Democratic Party, the third party, a very important swing party in British politics, Jeremy Thorpe, had been accused of conspiracy to murder. And was to go on trial for this extremely serious crime, which mostly involved outing him as a gay man. I obtained an interview with his accuser, who in our interview quite inadvertently revealed that in fact he had literally ratcheted up his story from one that began with Thorpe had made a couple of threatening phone calls to Thorpe had actually gone to threaten the man at his home to Thorpe had threatened to murder him to, well, he didn't murder anybody, but he did, somebody shot the man's dog. That's all I know. And it turned out that each turn of the ratchet was predicated on upping the bid from the Fleet Street tabloids in the UK, where paying for stories is, alas, conventional business. And the witness learned that, you know, a story of a menacing phone call was worth £500, the story of a menacing visit £1,000. But if he would accuse Jeremy Thorpe of accessory to murder, and as the brute who had shot the dog, that he would get £5,000 for the story. Well, guess what the story turned out to be. So I did this story on 2020, a story that was assigned to me principally because Rune Arledge had discovered that Don Hewitt was planning to lead the season's premiere of 60 Minutes with an accusation against Thorpe's story. And if I could blow that up, that would be immensely satisfying to Rune, who was a personal rival of Hewitt's. So we did the story, and the only mention of it in all of the British news media was a one-paragraph page filler on the London Times in which an unnamed inspector at Scotland Yard mentioned that the prosecution of Jeremy Thorpe had been done serious damage by irresponsible American television reporting. When the case finally came to trial, the witness came apart on the stands in exactly the same ludicrous way that he had on camera with me, and Thorpe was immediately acquitted. But in the UK, none of this could be published until the court had actually heard the case. In the United States, information can be made freely accessible for the public to judge. Had the British public had that information, the case would have never come to trial, which would have saved Mr. Thorpe months of humiliation and undoubtedly tens of thousands of pounds in legal fees. So America is the land of the free journalist. How pathetic that it's become the land of the unfree audience, that Al Jazeera English is considered so subversive, so dangerous, that there has been a campaign to convince local cable systems operators and satellite companies not to carry us. Now, I'm a Pollyanna by nature, but even that aside, I'm convinced that the lockout can't last much longer because it was based on two very plausible presumptions. The first presumption, and by far the most important, was, well, there's no market. BBC World's available on a lot of cable systems. Nobody's knocking down the doors to watch them, so why do we need another international news channel? Happily, since the day we went on the air, November 15th, there has been a continuing upward surge of visitors to our website, which is about the only way, absent a few very small satellite systems, that you can see us in the United States. But we are now up to millions of hits a week from North America, meaning from the United States, which I think will demonstrate to cable systems operators that, in fact, there is a market, not just for international news, but for international news of a very different sort, whereas BBC World is different perhaps in accent, but not really very different in its editorial focus from the American news channels or the American networks. And the second plausible presumption was, put on Al Jazeera and you're going to catch hell from the political right. Because until the day we went on the air, right-wing people were screaming all over Fox News and anywhere else they could gain access about Al Jazeera, the press agents for Osama bin Laden, Al Jazeera Terror TV. From November 15th to today, almost all of those people have gone completely silent. Why? Watch us for 10 minutes and you'll know. The programming puts the lie to the charge. We have a very straight news operation that gives you very high quality news, but admittedly from a global perspective that is more southern than northern or western. End of story. I hope that some of you have already watched. I hope that more of you will try to watch. The official way is www.aljazeera.net/English. And on the homepage, you will see Watch Now. Ping that, and you will have the Solomonic choice of 15 minutes free, endlessly renewable, I should note, at kind of annoying 56K speed. Or if you're willing to invest anywhere from $6 to $10 a month, you can subscribe to True High Speed Broadband. There is also a website called RelaVista.tv, www.relavista.tv, where I'm told you can get a high-quality broadband free of Al Jazeera English. I hope you will all check us out. I think I've probably ranted about long enough. For those of you who haven't enough warning, I'll give long answers to questions. But let's make sure that I'm talking about something that at least one person in the room is interested in hearing. And let's go to questions and answers about Al Jazeera and the world of reporting in the 21st century.
David, we've asked David to sit in the center. No reflection on his political orientation.
Left my white hat at home.
Well, thank you very much. That was really fascinating information. And the brave little network that they won't let you see. I think that's a great tagline for this.
Hopefully satellite. Soon obsolescent.
Right. And it brings me to the interest, the question that I wanted to bring up is that, you know, this clearly is an international news of a different content paradigm, a new paradigm that is emerging. And again, pointing out how irrelevant national boundaries are increasingly becoming, and satellite networks like yours broadcasting from the south to the north, allowing persons of the region to see themselves, see representations of themselves that might be inaccessible otherwise, has a tremendous amount of inherent value. And so my question is really about the relationship between not only people who are living in southern regions or third world regions, but people who are in diasporic communities. Because oftentimes media outlets, you know, the relationship between a diasporic community and media outlets is that these media help keep alive networks, global networks of people. And the fact that Al Jazeera English there's a lockout significantly affects the role that Al Jazeera could play in building community, building identity within diasporic communities.
Well, that's very true. And in fact, we all presumed that we had a deal with Comcast for access to their Detroit market. Comcast markets regionally so that each of its regional centers can acquire channels separately from the others. But Detroit, with Dearborn, with the heaviest concentration of Arab Americans in the United States, was felt to be particularly fertile ground to us. And things had progressed to the point where the contracts were literally drawn. Ink was on paper, and as you know, that's pretty much a sign that it is an all but done deal, and it fell apart in the last 24 hours for reasons I don't know. But I can't believe that this lockout is going to last, because I know that there has been a lot of protest from the Dearborn community. They were counting on being able to see us, and now we're denied to them.
I'm really interested in the way that you're talking about reframing the power structure in terms of the South and the way that there are these bureaus positioned in different parts of Latin America. And for those of you who know me, I'm very interested in media in Latin America, so this is of particular interest. And you mentioned that you have bureaus in Buenos Aires, Caracas, Sao Paulo, and Colombia,
Bogota, and Mexico City.
In Mexico City. And so one question really has to do, and we talked a little bit before about the difficulties of journalists in several of these countries where you do have bureaus, particularly Colombia and Mexico. How did those bureaus come about, and what then is the relationship with the other media, the dominant media in those countries, in terms of both Al Jazeera being able to be welcomed, the spillover into the improvement in local journalism, et cetera?
Well, first off, I think that because Latin America is not a particularly rich English as a second language zone, most of the Spanish or Portuguese language networks don't see us as a particular economic or cultural threat. But the point that you make about the dangers of reporting, not just in Latin America and but in the world, that's a theme I want to run with, if I may. Both statistically and in every other way, today is the most dangerous time in history to be a reporter. And there are several particular reasons for that. Number one is that the rule of state, rule of law states, like, say, the United States, seem much less meticulous about protecting journalists from their own militaries than ever before in history. And the number of journalists killed by American troops in Iraq is high and frightening. But much worse than that, the adversaries of the rule of law societies, number one, particularly since many of them are religious fundamentalists, regard journalists as the enemy because we are representations of the modernized, secularized world that they abhor and that they see as a corruption of the world as their fundamentalist religious beliefs meant it to be. But even more important than that, what used to keep us alive was our gatekeeper function. You want to talk to the world, you got to talk to me, and if you're going to talk to me, you got to keep me alive because I got to get my copy back to the bureau. And that worked very well because there was a kind of agreed consensus of they may be annoying, but if you wanted to reach a wider audience, you needed the news media. Enter the internet. We're not necessary anymore. All of these fundamentalist and political movements have their own myriad of websites, and they feel quite capable of reaching their audience without us, which means that they feel quite free to kill us. And in Iraq, in Mexico, and in Colombia, to name the three worst offending states in the world today, reporters are being killed at a truly frightening and horrifying rate.
To follow up on that, however, the old, maybe I'm old-fashioned, but the code of verifying sources, internet, you know, can propagate a lot of specious information, whereas reporters play a function of fact-checking and use of professional code of journalism. That's not something that has any kind of, places any constraint on the military and their treatment of reporters.
You know, I don't know exactly how to account for the fact that particularly the American military has become so careless of journalists' lives. And, you know, we at Al Jazeera know that particularly well, having had our bureaus in Baghdad and Kabul bombed by the American Air Force, and in Baghdad, correspondent was killed during that bombardment. We also have a cameraman who is an uncharged detainee at Guantanamo Bay. We are pretty sure that the reason that he is there is not any particular information that was given about him, but his association with Al Jazeera, that for several definable reasons the Bush Jr. administration loathes. So, you know, there are particular dangers in working for Al Jazeera. But I think the defining threat to it, the two defining threats are that our adversaries now, you know, view us as a specific enemy because we are empirical. We are modern, we are secular, and because they don't need us, because they can reach their audiences just fine over the internet. Now, the problem that you point to, which is that the internet has become a treasure trove of both information and pseudo-information, and that often it's almost impossible to definitively determine which is the real and which is the pseudo-information. That is a real problem. And for all of the romance of citizen journalism and for all of the important inputs that citizens can provide through cell phone cameras and through their own eyewitness testimony, still that's information, but it isn't necessarily journalism, because implicit in journalism is that it's organized information, that it's structured and pointed information. And the two other points to be made about the internet, which again is, you know, one of the revolutionary and defining new elements in our civilization, is that it matters radically how you use the internet. If you strip mine it, if you mine it horizontally, then the incredible wealth of points of view that are available on the internet, absorbing them, comparing them, contrasting them, and selecting among them is the best possible intellectual use of the resource. But if you drill mine it, as so many users of the internet do, and simply find endless replications of your own pre-existing point of view, then it, you know, the chances are that it will only confirm your prejudices and in no way broaden your information base. And the third thing to be said about the internet, and this is probably the most definitive, and that is the ultimate zero-based system is time. And as great as time spent on the internet can be, it always displaces time from some other kind of experience. And we are reaching something of a tipping point, many of us, where our virtual explorations are crippling our real explorations by displacing them for too many hours of the day.
Quite agree. And how ironic that the internet is how we can actually see Al Jazeera at this moment. And just...
Oh, you can't get too much about it.
Two things. One is the other satellite channel that's being boycotted, blacked out, is Telesur, is the other southern-looking regional network that's focusing on creating a pan-Latin American identity. And I understand that there is a relationship of sorts of sharing footage, gathering information between the two. Can you see broader a broader relationship working between these two to actually really try and shift a paradigm? Because, of course, they're... broadcasting is in Spanish, so they're reaching a very different and are very aware of indigenous communities as well.
And, you know, Telesur is, well, to use a cruel shorthand, it's Hugo Chavez TV. It is Venezuelan-based and very much dominated by its allegiance to Chavez's government. And a lot of their news can be tendentious. But the only way to learn that is to watch it. And the only way to learn both the good and the limits to the good of it is to watch it and watch it critically. So that, again, locking it away from American viewers only robs American viewers. And as I say, it's a tragedy that the country that it has the freest journalism on earth now has a captive audience that is denied its freedom to watch whatever it chooses and to draw its own conclusions. And whether that affects Al Jazeera or Telesur or any other outlet, Al-Manar is Hezbollah's television channel. I guarantee you that it's extremely tendentious in its reporting, but better to sample it and reject it than to only be prejudiced against it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have a few questions here from the audience that I'd like to pose to you, and I'm going to pair two of them. They're related to this question about restructuring media and media ownership. And one asks, will Al Jazeera English be financially self-sustaining? And the second question is Al Jazeera Arabic, I assume, or if it's Al Jazeera, the whole caboodle, a Kuwaiti public-owned company, Or is it, in other words, is it subsidized by the Kuwaiti government?
Now, Al Jazeera is owned by, effectively, the royal family of Qatar. And actually, I think that's a much more useful construct than the government of Qatar. I mean, Qatar is an authoritarian monarchy, and so it's a distinction with a slight difference, but it is a slight difference. Because Al Jazeera is very much an entrepreneur's enterprise, and the entrepreneur in this case is the Emir of Qatar. And this reminds me of the fact, and, you know, sort of guarantees my codger status. When I started at CBS, it was Bill Paley's company. And the day that he resigned as CEO and it became a corporate rather than an entrepreneurial company, there was a sea change. Paley was a megalomaniac. He honestly believed that anything that had the CBS logo on it was a personal reflection on him. He would call the newsroom in the middle of the night to say, "I just heard somebody mangle Reykjavik. Do you think I want the world to think I don't know how to pronounce Reykjavik? Get it right." You know, a lot of this was that he wanted to be able to sneer at Bob Sarnoff, who owned NBC, that, you know, take away Toscanini and you're a peasant. You know, all of your broadcasting is middle brow and second rate. I'm the quality guy. Well, guess what? That's why they called it the Tiffany Network, because it was the quality network, and especially the news division in the Paley years, the Murrow, Cronkite, Collingwood, Howard K. Smith years, was by far the dominant broadcast news organization in the United States, and that's because William Paley's ego demanded it. Well, the Emir of Qatar wants to be the William Paley of the 21st century, and this is great for us. As to our economic status, we heard when I signed up with them, I was told two absolutely glorious things. Ratings, don't worry about it. We're not worried about them. Profits, forget about it. Now, I think that there is a business plan, but it is a business plan available only to the people who are sitting on the second or third largest natural gas cache in the world. There are now 8 Al Jazeera networks. 3 of them, the 2 sports networks and the children's network, are making money. The sports networks are making pots of money. If you don't believe me, ask Disney why they bought ABC. It was not for ABC. It was for ESPN, out of which they make infinitely more money. So that the sustaining channels and Al Jazeera Arabic news is now very close to being a break-even operation. Averaged out over all 8 channels, probably doesn't represent a huge financial drain. And my guess is that, you know, 10, 20, 30 years down the line, the network, which by then will probably be 15 or 20 channels, will be taken public. And a 49% share will be put on some stock market. And I guarantee you, they'll make back all of that loss leader money right then. But it is a very liberating business plan for us in that we are freed from worrying about profits or sponsors. Apparently, just as viewership has far exceeded the optimistic projections, so is advertising. So that we're doing better than we expected. But, you know, my guess is that if advertising brings in 5% of costs, we're doing amazingly well.
Did you want to answer? The content of what we're not seeing in the U.S., can you tell us a little bit about a typical story that you're working on? For example.
Well, let me give you a couple of big stories that we have beaten the pants off of our opposition on. Probably the most significant is the war in Somalia. And the most significant part of that is America's very significant role in the war in Somalia. Until things fell apart again about a month ago, there was a very active cadre of military and intelligence people who were proposing Somalia as the new paradigm for low-intensity conflict. And in the rush of pride attendant on that judgment, I was actually able to get the Chief of Naval Operations, the Navy's representative to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to give me at least a broad sketch of the order of battle in Somalia, which was American Special Operations troops on the ground weeks in advance of the invasion, American and other private military contractors actively engaged not only in training but in assisting the battlefield operations of the third element, a willing client state, in this case the Ethiopian Army. This is very important news if indeed the military and intelligence organizations do think that this is the new paradigm and that this is a set of weapons which they are anxious to use to eradicate what they see as low-intensity conflicts around the world, because as the subsequent months are proving, it is a very, very doubtful success and a very, very dangerous to the local population tactic. The really interesting thing about the war in Somalia is that it was virtually a war without witnesses. The invasion route was cleared in advance of potential witnesses, and the pursuit route, as the Islamic Courts Union fighters retreated from Mogadishu to the southeast along the Indian Ocean coast and down towards the Kenyan border, all of the villagers in that region were told that if you are seen outside your house after dark, it will be presumed that you are a terrorist and will be killed. And so nobody knows who did what to whom. The indications are that there were some successes, that at least one of our AC-130 gunship attacks did take out a nest of both confirmed Islamic Courts fighters, but also possibly some foreign Islamist advisors and colleagues. But it's also equally certain that there were a couple of horrible catastrophes, one in which a group of migrant goat herders who apparently were after dark and to whom the satellite surveillance could not discriminate them from terrorists, and so they were all blown up and killed. Events like that do America no good abroad. You know, we really do have to consider that if you ask the world's population today what is the leading export of the United States, they would not tell you Hollywood movies, MTV, blue jeans, or Coca-Cola. They would tell you war. You know, one of the unique things and great blessings, although it's become, I think, to be a crippling condition of American history, is that we've had no wars on our soil since 1865. When I was 5 years old, I met an 86-year-old woman who had been born into slavery, so that I had a tangential brush with someone who had actually had, as a 5 or 6 year old herself, a tangential brush with what it's like to have war on your territory. But almost nobody in the United States today has had even that tangential brush with war. And let me tell you that even the experience of fighting war abroad and being a soldier, a combatant in war, is psychologically quite different from having war on your territory, from going to bed at night absolutely uncertain that your family will wake up in the morning, that your kids can go to school the next day, that your wife can go shopping without being picked off by a sniper or blown up by a roadside bomb. The horror that is war is something that Americans are almost completely innocent of. And alas, the American media have conspired to reinforce that innocence by presenting a radically Baudelaireized picture of war and its effects on the ground and even of its effects on American soldiers. I mean, after all, we're not allowed to show the coffins coming home unless the family or, as in the case of Louisiana National Guard, the guard unit specifically solicits coverage. Otherwise, the blanket policy is thou shalt not show it. No wonder Americans feel so free to back governments that recklessly promulgate war on others, because we're clueless as to what that means. And as, again, somebody who never aspired to be a war correspondent, and although I'm interested in the post-war, I'm not interested in war. And the problem is that every damn post-war I go to turns out to be still at war when I'm there, and at less than full-blown scale war, so that I haven't seen real war and real combat, but I've seen more than enough to know that promulgating it, recommending it to others, is a very, very heartless and I think fundamentally unwise choice.
Well, here are two related questions that I would pair from the audience, following on what you have just said. Why did ABC embed itself in the war movement instead of the peace movement from 2002 or 2003 with the invasion of Iraq to the present day? And then...
There are actually very easy answers to both questions. First off, there's no need to embed in the peace movement. The peace movement is perfectly open. It is permeable, as almost all public movements in the United States are, and that therefore no special arrangements are necessary to cover it. On the other hand, has the American coverage of the anti-war movement been shameful? Yes, it has. My wife used to work for MSNBC. The huge anti-war rally in New York City that was held just before the critical UN vote that refused to authorize the war. MSNBC covered the pregame show with hourly reports, but once it was clear that the numbers were going to radically exceed pregame estimates and were going to be in the hundreds of thousands, MSNBC never went back to cover it. Now, this is shameful. This is blinding your own audience. This is, you know, contravening your own reason for being. But in general, the whole journalistic attitude towards this decade's anti-war movement has sort of been there, seen that 30 years ago, didn't stop the war then, ain't going to stop it now, therefore it's not worth covering. This is a grave error, in my opinion. Mm-hmm.
Then relatedly, would outcomes in Iraq be different if Americans were Al Jazeera informed?
That's a tough question. I think so. I think that if Al Jazeera's coverage of the Iraq War had been available from the beginning, you know, the terrible thing about American foreign correspondenting, and I say this both as somebody who did it for a long time, but also was blessed to work at Nightline, which played completely by its own rules. But in general, American foreign reporting is all about us. It's all about what Americans are doing in state X, state Y, or state Z, or what is happening in those states that could directly influence for good or ill America. The glory of Al Jazeera English's coverage is that it's all about them. What's happening to the Iraqis in Iraq? For Nightline, I have to say that I feel that we did indeed cover the impact of the war on the Iraqis. And I'm, you know, proud to say that by June 03, I was reporting that the primary problem was the fact that the various sectarian and party militias outgunned the central government, and that as long as that was true and the government had neither the will nor the means to control them, that there would be no governance, no order, and no security in Iraq, and that absent security there would be neither physical infrastructure rebuilding nor social reconciliation, and that the isolation of the Sunni triangle, which is, by the way, not where the majority of Sunnis in Iraq live. It is the only area in which they are a very narrow majority of the population, but it is hardly a homogeneous Sunni region. But that as long as they were cited for exclusion from the rest of Iraq, that this would work definitively against the reconciliation occupation and reconstruction of Iraq. So, yeah, we did report those stories, but Nightline was the exception in reporting them and unique in reporting them at a length and depth that might have actually convinced you that what we were reporting had a basis in fact rather than just sloganeering. I think if Al Jazeera had been available to the American public, we would have known much sooner how deeply offended the Iraqis were from the beginning by the occupation, how deeply ingrained anti-colonial values were in Iraq, and how the default disposition of virtually every Iraqi was, don't let the white boys tell you how to do it. Iraq is for the Iraqis. And that, you know, was a crippling mentality for any occupation force. But my second visit to Iraq was January, February 04. My third and last was May, June 04. Between February and May 04 was when Abu Ghraib was revealed and the first Battle of Fallujah took place. And when I got back in May, it was an entirely different planet. Iraqis who in February were willing to give the occupation, hated as it was, the benefit of the doubt, that it might all turn out for their benefit, by May were simply saying, just get out of here. Just leave us alone. You don't have anything to teach us. You're not accomplishing any of your, much less our, purposes. Get out of here. I think Al Jazeera would have communicated that much more frequently, much more baldly, much more inescapably than the American news media did. My feeling is that basically since April or May 04, the only thing that we have been fighting for is the right to stay, which hardly seems to be a bankable value to me. So I guess that would be my answer. Yes, I think it would have made a difference. Just as I hope that our reporting on Somalia will engender a debate about, well, what is the proper use of American forces abroad? And we may aspire to create democracies, but in states that have no democratic tradition and no unifying principle, it may in fact be a pipe dream. And that when you impose the condition of war on a place, wars are much easier to start than to stop. And war is a condition in which only one thing matters: force on the ground. Force rules everything. Try living under those conditions. You wouldn't like it. Nobody likes it. To impose those conditions on third-party states because we think it may be in our, or we even may think it be in their interest, boy, you pull that thread on the sleeve and, you know, it all comes apart. And so far, think of the last war that we have fought that we've been able to bring to a truly stable and satisfying conclusion. You got to go back a long ways. And certainly none of the wars of the last 15 years fit into that category.
Well, let's go ahead and do another question.
Do you have a question?
Yeah. No, I mean, go ahead and do it.
The reportage and perspective that you just report from Iraq, just citing that instance, could have a tremendous impact on the presidential debates in the upcoming election in 2008, in terms of engendering knowing that the Iraqis don't welcome the occupation to the extent that you're describing, could fuel U.S. public opinion against the war as well. And, you know, in light of that as well, another question is that, you know, Al Jazeera English has been said to be sympathetic to the Palestinians in the occupied territories of Israel-Palestine. And would you think that if the Al Jazeera English were able to be broadcast in the United States, that that would influence public opinion about the Israel-Palestine question?
The whole question of how Al Jazeera English covers the Israel-Palestine complex is a very interesting and I think a very subtle one. It certainly suggests to me that God, the Godhead, is a diverse minded entity in that the first day that we went on the air, November 15th, 06, the lead developing story of the day was a rocket that went into the Israeli town of Sderot from Gaza and killed an elderly Israeli woman who was the first Israeli casualty since the fighting in Lebanon had ended 6 months before, first Israeli fatality. And Al Jazeera English covered it like crazy, which allowed us to demonstrate our even-handedness. If you watched Al Jazeera Arabic's coverage of the war in Lebanon, you would note that they saturated both Israel and Lebanon, and in both places their take on the story was the same, and the take was, hey, innocent civilians are being murdered here. That's a crime. How can you justify destruction and slaughter like this of Israeli Arabs, Israeli Jews, and Lebanese? If we have an ideological perspective, it is the classic tabloid perspective of we're for the people. Al Jazeera Arabic is not the voice of Osama. It is the voice of the Arab street. And they are proud of reflecting public opinion in the Arab world. Our prejudice is for innocent civilians. And we were able to demonstrate it on our first day of coverage. And of course, as the story developed, the headline went from Palestinian rocket kills Israeli woman to Gaza Strip braces for Israeli retaliation. And then, 2 or 3 hours of Israeli retaliation and so on. And to me, this was a perfect illustration of news the way it's supposed to be, of even-handed coverage, but with a preference for the people, if you will.
Now, just...
Let me add one more thing.
Go ahead.
Let me fess up. When the Mecca agreement that brought about the Palestinian unity government was announced, our people, frankly, I thought, lost their minds. And they greeted it as a revolutionary, almost heaven-sent agreement, because, at the very least, it relieved what had become a civil war in Gaza and somewhat in the West Bank that was killing, again, innocent Palestinian civilians every day. And clearly there can be no progress towards peace if there are not credible negotiating partners, and some sort of unified Palestinian government is absolutely necessary. And so there were a lot of benign reasons for rejoicing. Unfortunately, in the news business, rejoicing ain't our business. But what happened is, as the clock spun and as coverage left Doha and London and got to us, our take on the story was, great agreement if it works, but here are the inbuilt impediments. There is nothing about this agreement which necessarily obviates the arms race that the United States and the Saudis on one side, supplying Abu Mazen's security force, and Syria and Iran supplying Hamas with guns on the other side, that had really stoked the civil war. There was nothing in the Mecca agreement that assured that that arms race would stop. There was nothing in the Mecca agreement that said that the unity government would actually function. There was nothing in the Mecca agreement that said that Hamas would really divide the party from the government and allow the government to participate in peace talks. So that I felt that our coverage from Doha, to a slightly lesser degree from London, was kind of feeble, because they led with their hearts. I understood where their hearts were coming from, but, you know, call me a cynic or just call me a news guy. To me, inherent in the story was not just the achievements, but the inherent difficulties of it. So that, you know, yes, where we're coming from can color our point of view, but I'm convinced that the sort of quattro corrective of moving from news center to news center to news center to news center can adjust for those partisan, if you will, judgments to which we're all party. We spent a lot of time today talking about the sort of chimera of objectivity. nobody's objective. We are all the product of our experience, our upbringing, the incidents of our lives. So aspiring to objectivity is, it seems to me, a complete waste of time and a misplacement of emphasis, because it really emphasizes the reporter and what's going on in his mind. That is not our job. It's not my job to tell you what I think. It's my job to tell you what I think is there. So that what we're seeking is not objectivity, but transparency. Not a neutering or balancing of our internal clocks, but a radical focus and devotion to what is out there, what the reality is, whether it be comforting or discomforting, whether it be good or evil. And, you know, the most discomforting and the most evil are the most necessary stories, because I think if you really get down to it, what is the job of reporting? The answer is we are the People's Intelligence Service. It is our job to warn you of what is out there, as well as to cheer you about the good things that are out there. And that sometimes means showing you Osama bin Laden in all of his hideousness. Because if you don't see it, you ain't going to get it.
I think I know the answer to what I'm about to say, but there was a great deal made when you originally took this job, which you have described as a wonderful adventure, that you're Jewish. And so has any of that abated, given what you've just described in terms of the reporting?
I guess it's abated a little. There are a lot of people, especially a lot of other Jewish people, who find it unforgivable that I would work for an Arab employer. And again, this is something that we were talking about this afternoon, for a news service that takes Islam seriously. That's not the same thing as being Islamic or Islamist. It is not giving priority to Islam over other religions. It is saying that you cannot understand the Arabic-speaking world or the Islamic world if you don't take religion, religious obligation, and religious implications in all other aspects of culture and daily life seriously. I am Jewish. I am not a regular temple goer, but I have always been Jewish. Everything about my personality, from my literary taste to my sense of humor, is imbued in my Judaism, and I always confirm my Judaism, whether it be to Stephen Colbert or to an Iraqi on the street. And let me tell you, it's a lot more uncomfortable to confirm it to an Iraqi on the street. But the truth is the truth. And if you want people to entrust often uncomfortable truths honestly to you, which is, after all, what reporting is all about, you owe it to them to be as truthful. And in fact, I always found it impossible to wear a flak jacket when I was interviewing somebody who wasn't wearing a flak jacket. It seemed to me that it colored the whole conversation if I were in my defensive shell and he or she were utterly vulnerable. And in fact, the two things that made me decide after June 2004 that I would stop volunteering to go to Iraq was, number two, that it was so dangerous that I could not go out onto the street, particularly with another Western camera crew. And again, the defining difference between television and both radio and print is there you can go out one at a time, dress up any way you want, and successfully fool people that you're just another citizen. Citizens don't go around with a guy carrying a $100,000 camera on his shoulder and $50,000 worth of video recording and sound recording equipment. But the number one reason was not the danger to me. It was that anybody seen talking to me on the street was a marked person. Anybody whose home was noted to have been visited by me and the camera crew would be like painting a red X on their door and marking them for harassment or much worse. I'm willing to do my own risk-benefit calculus, and frankly, I did it and it didn't add up to me, but I can't be put in the position of trying to do risk-benefit analysis for the people I'm talking to, when it was clear to me that I was putting their lives in danger by trying to report. I knew that it was, for me at least, insupportable to continue to try and report. And I have to say that I to this day, feel very ambivalent about the decision, one, because it is a very important story, and for sheer ego, you want to report the world's great stories. But as I say, those two risk-benefit analyses just didn't add up to me. There was not a reporting reward calling out on the telephone from the Bureau. There was a question earlier about embedding. Mm-hmm. I've never embedded, but I know and respect a lot of correspondents who have. It is a useful tool, and it gets you access to stories that you could not otherwise get access to. And although the U.S. military does try and spin stories, it does not try to censor stories, and only very, very rarely, Jessica Lynch obviously comes to mind, do they make up and try and sell false stories. So that actually there is real reporting value to being an embed. Poisonally, I would much rather take the risk of operating as a unilateral, as they called us, because you have more access to a wider variety of things. The problem with embed reporting is when the unilaterals are basically scared off and embedded reporting becomes dominant, because it is a blinkered view, and blinkered views are very dangerous as well as inadequate.
Thank you. Oh, okay. Besides paying for broadband access to the website, what can we do to help end the lockout on cable providers carrying Al Jazeera English?
Well, we're going to form up with pitchforks and torches right outside. I suppose in some ways the best thing that you can do is to subscribe to one of the internet services, which will further evidence your curiosity and interest and value for the product. I think that it's also worth writing to your local cable system operator or satellite service and saying, why is it that you're afraid to put this on? I and many of my friends feel that we are part of a market that does want this product, and we can't think in the land of the free and the home of the brave, the place ruled by the First Amendment to the Constitution, that there's any excuse for sheltering ourselves against these alternative points of view.
And as you've said, the best antidote to bad judgment or bad arguments or a good argument.
You know, sunshine, as they say, is the best disinfectant. And you can't make a judgment in ignorance. So take the risk of exposing yourself to everything, and then you'll make your judgments about it. And if your judgment is, I don't like their point of view or I don't trust what they're reporting, then that's a very honest and valid judgment. But judgments simply taken in ignorance or being scared off by somebody else's pronouncements of what they think we're going to be before we even air is shooting yourself in the intellectual foot if you've got one.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.